Okay. So we'll come back. Welcome back, everybody. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's such a beautiful, majestic space. It's almost as if the meditation just happens. You don't have to try. So what I thought I would do, you know, I don't know you, you don't know me, so I thought, you know, I'm just going to share what feels intuitively right to share tonight, and that's the best that I can do, right? I can't kind of anticipate what you need or what you want, and so I'm anticipating what I need and what I want, which is to talk about something that's really my favorite topic, especially within Dharma. And it is the teachings on the view, the perspective, the outlook. Really, it's like, what's the map? Or what are we doing here? What is the perspective that the Buddha offered so long ago that's still so poignant to us today? And this is found within what the Buddha taught as the Eightfold Noble Path. The Eightfold Noble Path is the final teachings within the teachings on the Four Noble Truths. So I'm sure all of us as Dharma students, we're familiar with these terms a little bit, but I'll just quickly overview those and then dive into that, the first of the Eightfold Noble Path, which is the right view or correct or holy view. So when the Buddha attained enlightenment 2600 years ago under the Bodhi tree, it said that he didn't plan on teaching because he didn't feel that people would be able to grok or understand or maybe even want to know what he uncovered, the truth of existence, the truth of why we suffer, and so on. And so the story goes that he began to walk and wander. And after a while, he found his way to Varanasi, where he encountered some old friends, some old ascetics that he had practiced with in the forest for many years. They practiced a lot of austerities together. And after about 6 years of doing that, the Buddha almost died. And so he eased off of these radical austere practices of like not eating, burying your head in the sand and the earth, you know, really restraining yourself from all your craving, your desire, your wants, your needs to get at something more transcendent. So that was the technique that these guys were studying, were doing together in the forest. Well, the Buddha left that and then ate a little bit and felt better, and then he was able to attain enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. So, as the Buddha's wandering into Varanasi, after he's awakened, he runs into these old friends. And they saw him coming from afar, and at first they're like, oh, there's the Buddha. He copped out, you know. he's such a loser, you know, let's not talk to him. But then as he drew closer, they could see that something was special about him. He had an aura about him. And they could see that. And so they asked him to come over and tell them what he had discovered. And at first he said, you know, I don't know if you'll understand or if you really want to know. And they said, no, please tell us. We can tell that something, that you've discovered something. Maybe it's what we've been looking for too. And so the first teaching that he ever gave was on the Four Noble Truths. And the first of those truths is the truth that life is infused or pervaded by suffering, that we suffer in this life. But that there's some good news too, that he discovered what the source of that suffering was. That's the second noble truth. And the source of that suffering is the craving that we always feel at this really deep core, almost biological level. Probably is biological and spiritual. But that we are always craving for something, for pleasure, for avoiding pain, craving for some kind of satisfaction that is just out of our reach. And that this craving stems from our misunderstanding or our ignorance of our true nature. We're disconnected from our true nature, because if we were connected to our true nature, we wouldn't crave for something else. We wouldn't want to get high. We wouldn't want to have sex. We wouldn't want to have alcohol. We wouldn't need to watch TV, you know, because we'd have that sense of contentment and satisfaction right here, right now. We wouldn't buy things. Capitalism would collapse. So that's the second noble truth, is that there's a source of suffering, that you can actually find the cause of suffering, which is craving, which comes about because we're ignorant of our true nature. So meditation, you can feel that. And meditation is getting us closer to abiding in that true nature, so that then we can release that habitual craving tendency that drives us into all sorts of trouble. And so then the third noble truth is the truth that suffering can cease. The cessation of suffering is the third noble truth that he taught to this group of men in the forest. And so he said, you know, it's true we suffer, there's a cause of suffering, and because we can identify the cause of suffering, then we can uproot it. We can have this suffering cease. And how do we do that? We follow the fourth truth, which is the Eightfold Noble Path. So then, like, the fourth truth opens up like an accordion or a fan into this whole other matrix of beautiful teachings. And so then he taught on the Eightfold Path. And so the first of the Eightfold Path is this right or correct, or I just like to say, you know, like aligned or balanced, a wholesome view. The view. So he starts from the pinnacle, right? The view of the mountaintop. He starts from the mountaintop and gives us a perspective. What is the view that he laid out that was different than what most people were practicing or thinking about, talking about, teaching? And the view, he says, I'd like to quote a sutra, the words of the Buddha. He said, in regards to right view, regard this fleeting world like this. You could even close your eyes, because the imagery that he lays out is so beautiful. Like stars fading and vanishing at dawn. Like bubbles on a fast-moving stream. Like morning dewdrops evaporating from a blade of grass. Like a candle flickering in a strong wind. Echoes, mirages, phantoms, hallucinations, and like a dream. So the Buddha taught that the perspective or the view is to view or regard the whole world, the whole phenomenal world, but not just that which we perceive out there, but also what's happening in here, our thoughts, feelings, to be like a dream, like a mirage, like a hallucination, and so on. And so he's pointing to the understanding of what is called in Sanskrit shunyata or shunyata, and that means emptiness. I like to translate it as the empty fullness, or the interdependent full emptiness. It's that akashic field, or that field of pure potential, not yet manifest, but everywhere, pervading everything. But it's not like a fabric that's pervading everything. It's actually like just the way that all things, all phenomena, all appearances are existing in this very moment. Everything is always interrelatedly arising and dissolving. And because of that, nothing has an inherent solidity. So because it doesn't have any inherent solidity, it is therefore like a dream, like a bubble on a stream. I was contemplating this last night as I was watching the debate. Wow, this is like a bad dream. But it's all smoke and mirrors. Of course, there is reality to it. People make policy. All of us, we are sitting on a real floor, on a real chair, in a real cathedral. I'm here, you're there. I mean, we're here. It's not that things don't exist. It's not that Trump isn't doing his strange song and dance and Hillary's not doing her strange song and dance. But yes, we are here, but we're all interrelatedly arising and abiding and then passing away from nanosecond to nanosecond in this kind of interrelated, interdependent perception game. You know, it's like I'm dependent on your perception of me. My voice is dependent upon your auditory experience of my voice. We're all co-dependent, for good or for better or for worse. So, shunyata is what the Buddha is talking about or was pointing towards in this quotation, is understanding the way that things truly abide, the dharma, the natural way of abiding is this empty nature, this interdependent nature. And also in terms of the meditative path, as meditators, what this means is that we start to become familiar with that truth, with that experience in here, in our thoughts, in our feelings, in our likes, our dislikes, our preferences, our aversions, our fantasies, our fears, our angers, our sadness, all of this stuff, we start to experience all phenomena, whether it's thoughts, feelings, sound, touch, sights, all of these things we're experiencing as interrelated events arising and passing away. And there's something so healing about that because we're no longer able to then fixate on them. We no longer want to fixate on them and turn them into things that rule us, that imprison us, that cause us to suffer in a sense because we're believing so wholeheartedly and stubbornly to them. You see what I mean? So the implications of this quotation from the Buddha are very profound for meditators because we turn that inside. We turn it back in on itself and say, okay, well, how does this apply to our inner life? And that's when we really start to take more responsibility for our suffering, our cause of suffering, our cessation from suffering, and our path, the four aspects I just mentioned. We can't blame, we don't blame, you know, we're less likely to blame. Oh, it's my parents' fault, it's the government's fault. You know, it can't even be my fault anymore because there's no me. There's a fun book out by a wonderful teacher named Anam Thubten. I haven't read the book, but I love the title. No self, no problem. No self, no, you don't need to read the book. It's just such a great title. It's like as long as there's a self to defend, right? Like, I'm great, or I'm a piece of shit, or anything in between, then there's suffering. It's all wrapped up like a nice ribbon and a paper, wrapping paper, all around that, because I have to defend it, I have to assert it, I have to prove it. Or I have to beat it up because I don't like it, right? So it's like this contrived sense of self, this mistaken sense of identity can cause a lot of suffering. So what do I mean? Well, what I'd like to bring up is the beautiful and often quoted passage from the Heart Sutra, which is more of a Mahayana sutra. So it's after the early phase of Buddhism, then around the turn of the millennium, you had kind of a whole flowering of new thought, a renaissance, so to speak, within Dharma, because it had gotten kind of stale. The Buddha taught and lived around 500 BCE, before the Common Era. And the teaching, after he died, the teachings, were written down a couple hundred years, a hundred to 200 years after the death of the Buddha, his teachings were written down. They weren't written down in his lifetime. Then they became, the monastic order, monasteries, the government, things started to get more solidified. And so around the turn of the millennium, the people, the 99%, were like, no, we want to be able to practice. We don't want to have to go to the priest, go to the monastery to have our prayers fulfilled. So in the Mahayana era, they built upon the teachings of the earlier of the Buddha, and then opened it more for lay practitioners to be able to be authentic practitioners. In the Mahayana era, teachings began to assert that women could attain enlightenment without taking rebirth in a man's body first. The earlier teachings were that women would have to be reborn as a man in order to become enlightened. So I think that's a nice upgrade. but also lay practitioners could be serious practitioners and awaken, become bodhisattvas, become Buddhas. And before that, you had to be a monastic. So there's a big shift. So there were some very well-known sutras or teachings, texts that came out of that era. And one is called the Heart Sutra. And in the Heart Sutra, there's a famous quotation that says, "Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Form is none other than emptiness, and emptiness is none other than form." So what that means is form, meaning like this, form is there. But while at the same time it's there, it's also empty of intrinsic existence. It's empty of a separate, independent, solidly existing selfhood. So that's form is emptiness. And then you flip it upside down and you say, well, also emptiness is form. Because out of emptiness, out of co-arising, interdependent phenomenon, events and materials arising and passing, we get form. It said that without emptiness, form couldn't manifest, because everything would be stuck and static. There'd be no birth and death. So form is emptiness, emptiness is form. They're not separate. And the whole point of the reason why I'm saying this is because it's like, yes, even though I'm empty of intrinsic existence, I'm still here. I'm not gone. And in the meditation, I pointed to that a bit, where if you can drop beneath the surface level of thought, you drop into something. It's not like you drop into a nothingness. You drop into a deeper wellspring of awareness, like with a capital A. Jnana is the Sanskrit term, or Rigpa in Tibetan. And that's the vast awareness that is our true nature, that is also shunyata, the empty fullness. We are everything. We are nothing, all at the same time. The subject-object duality collapses in that space. So Chogyam Trungpa talks about this empty or illusory nature of thoughts to be like paper tigers. And I love this image, paper tigers, because tigers are so scary. You think of a tiger, you think, oh, it's kind of like our thoughts, like, oh. We get so frightened and so wrapped up in our thoughts. But then when you look behind the surface or you look around the corner, you look behind it, you see, oh, it's just a paper tiger. It's not really scary. It's not going to hurt me. So this image of paper tiger is really great. I've been thinking about that a lot. He also says that thoughts and phenomena are like a mask, like in a masquerade. You look behind the mask and you just see it's empty and it has holes and there's nothing behind the mask. But when you look at the mask, you think, oh my God. So it's like that. Training yourself up in that so that you can drop into that on a moment's notice. You know, somebody insults you, something really weird or uncomfortable happens. Whoa, that's scary, but oh, it's not. It's like a paper tiger. Let's look behind the surface here. That's about maturing and developing more wisdom in our life as well. And in the Lojong teachings of Mahayana also, the Lojong means mind training. Maybe some of you have heard of Lojong teachings. There's a wonderful slogan in the mind training teachings that's very similar to the Buddha's words that I read a moment ago. And it simply says, regard all dharmas as dreams. Regard all dharmas as dreams. And in this context, dharmas is like means phenomena, appearances. So when you see the word dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, with a little d, it refers to this, like phenomena, all appearances, all dharmas. But when you see dharma with a capital D, that is Buddhism, really. It's the teachings of the Buddha, the Dharma. And Dharma in that context refers more to truth or understanding the way things are. So even before Buddha, you had the word Dharma. You know, in the early Vedic teachings, Dharma was there all over the place. So he just kind of took it and enhanced it and made it paramount and used that word. And we refer to Buddhism, the Buddha's teachings, as Dharma. But really all the Buddha said is, I'm just teaching the truth. I'm not trying to establish a religion. I'm just teaching the way I see things, the way they are. And so you can see how Dharma with a little d and Dharma with a big D can kind of cross over and correlate a bit. Because if you can understand the way all appearances arise and pass away, then you're understanding truth. You're understanding the way things are. And the other aspect of shunyata, or this empty nature of all phenomena, is impermanence. And that's a very large other aspect of these teachings on the view and how do we understand the world. What is our perspective in the world? So from the Buddha's teachings, he's saying to have right view means to understand the empty, full nature of all things, that things are impermanent, they rise, abide, and then pass away. Nothing is permanent. And also another aspect of right view is, it's kind of more philosophical, is it's said that people who are aligned with reality or holding this right view don't fall into the two extremes of nihilism on the one side, where you say nothing exists, which would be misunderstanding shunyata, emptiness, right? And then on the other side is eternalism, not falling into that extreme either, that things always exist, or even like the world will always exist, or God always exists. So not falling into those two extremes is also one aspect of having right view. And that's why the Dharma is called the middle path. You know, the Dalai Lama talks about this a lot. I walk the middle path between those two extremes. And then another aspect of right view is understanding cause and effect, or karma. And to acknowledge that karma exists. That for every action, there's a reaction. I think that's Newton's second law. Every action has a reaction. You know, if I'm sowing negative seeds, then negative things will happen to me. If I'm sowing positive seeds, positive things. It's not always that predictable. It's more complicated than that, of course. But the beautiful thing about karma, it comes from the verbal root kr, which is kr with a dot under it, which is related to the word action, like krama, or kar, like Surya Namaskar for the yogis in the room. It means action, And so karma means action, literally. So how are our actions in the world? And what kind of reactions do our actions bring about? So when you're in the view, you understand that I need to be careful with my actions, whether it's speech, bodily actions, because I'm sowing future seeds of karma. The great Buddhist master who brought Buddhism to Tibet, his name was Padmasambhava, and he lived in the 8th century CE. And he has a beautiful saying. He said that although my view is as vast as space, my actions, my behavior, is as fine as barley flour. If you've ever eaten tsampa or been to Tibet, or you know of Tibetan culture, they've grind the barley flour, they toast it and then grind it really fine into a beautiful fine flour. So he was referring to that. Like, our actions have to be refined. We have to have integrity and be kind and compassionate and loving people. So although my view is as vast as space, vast as the sky, my behavior is as fine as barley flour. And he was teaching that in response to some misguided tendencies, especially in the tantric era that was later. People got really into the siddhis, the accomplishments and the powers that come about through meditative absorption and mantra and all these things. Kind of like sorcerers, you know, they started playing with it. And they didn't have the compassion to, you know, direct their actions. And so many of the good Buddhist tantric masters were admonishing them and saying, you have to have integrity and compassion and have good behavior. So that's where compassion comes in, because I love that Thich Nhat Hanh talks a lot about this. He says that through wisdom or understanding, this is this prajna or wisdom, prajna, that understands the nature of all reality, that naturally leads to a greater capacity for having a compassionate heart. Because with understanding comes compassion. If you understand where somebody's coming from or why they're angry or why they act the way they do, for example, then you're more able to feel compassion for them. It's like you can walk in their shoes and you can go, oh, okay, I can see why they're maybe a little angry or sad or suffering. That through understanding, we are able to open and soften our heart and feel more compassion for others and for ourselves. So the wisdom into reality has to be balanced with a loving heart. That if you just have wisdom, it said it's like a bird who only has one wing. So the wisdom is one wing, and then the compassion is the other wing. And with the two wings, you can coast and fly beautifully through your life. So maybe opening it up to any comments or questions now on the view and what was shared. And we have a couple minutes. If there's anything, yes. Yes. Okay. Right. You can apply that to anything. So, but it makes sense why birth and death would be one way, easy way to understand it. But you can also understand it in terms of like objects. Form is emptiness, meaning form, like say, I'll just use the bell because it's the prettiest thing in my field of vision, this beautiful golden bell. It looks its form, right? It's really solid. But if you were to look at it under an electron microscope, you would see that there's a lot of space in between the molecules, the atoms. And so you see the emptiness within the form. And then also, kind of more as a thought experiment, you can also think of it in terms of, like, we call this a bell, but to other cultures, it's named other things. Somebody else might come along and go, no, it's a hat. What are you talking about? You know, it's a drinking vessel. So also our labels impute identity onto things, but that's also a relative term, really, bell. In Tibetan, it's dribu. So I don't know what it is in Sanskrit. Kandi? Gandhi. Right? So we all have different cultures, different languages have different names for this. So, but also, this bell came about due to the metals that were mined in the earth, the fire that melted those metals down and made them able to be mixed together. The goldsmith or whoever smith who was able to shape the bell, the materials, the intention, the driving market need for the bell, all of these different aspects brought this bell into being so that it's taken this shape right here and right now. So due to that, you would say it's interdependent. It's dependent upon all of these causes and conditions that gave rise to the bell. Like Thich Nhat Hanh has a beautiful way of describing it. He says, look at this like a piece of paper. Like we all look here and we think, oh, that's just a piece of paper with some black ink on it. But he said, if you look at the paper with the eyes of the Buddha, you see the tree, you see the air, the water, the cloud that gave the water to make the tree. You see the lumberjack who cut down the tree. You see the mill, the press, the ink, all of that. You see everything that goes into creating that. So the form is empty, but empty in this kind of Buddhist way of empty, which means actually interdependence. Really, I mean, it's a complicated term because the term in Sanskrit literally does mean emptiness. In Tibetan also it's tongpa nyi. Tongpa is shunya. Nyi means ta. So it's like the emptiness. It's the quality of things. It's not, like, emptiness isn't a thing. Like, Nagarjuna, one of the great Buddhist scholars, says you shouldn't reify emptiness as a thing. Emptiness is empty of intrinsic existence, too. It's beautiful philosophy. It's really interesting. It's a kind of philosophy that can take you into a higher state, you know, a different state of consciousness. So form is empty. And then emptiness is form. We can't have form without emptiness. And we can't have emptiness without form because it's always, it's arising, it's birthing and dying, birthing and dying. That's the nature of this universe. So they're codependent. Like if form wasn't empty of intrinsic existence, it couldn't come into being and it, you know what I mean? And it couldn't die because it would be stuck in some static permanence. It's unrealistic. Is that good? Okay. Thank you. Good question. I think that brings us to 9:01. So I want to honor your time. So let's just take a moment and sit quietly and feel that in the body, not just in the head, the emptiness, the rising and falling of the breath, rising and falling, the birthing and passing away of sensations, of thoughts, sound.